Welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast that spotlights some of the area's most compelling women. Ramona Diaz has always been an observer. Inspired by her upbringing, the Baltimore-based filmmaker tells character-driven stories that often highlight the diversity of the Filipino experience. Ramona's documentary credits include Imelda, about the former First Lady of the Philippines, The Learning, which follows Filipino teachers in Baltimore City, and Don't Stop Believin', which tells the story of the band Journey finding their new Filipino lead singer, Arnel Pineda, on YouTube and Arnel's first tour with the band. Most recently, Ramona directed Motherland, in which the viewer is a fly on the wall at one of the busiest maternity hospitals in the world, in Manila. That film won the Special Jury Award for Commanding Vision at Sundance this year. Ramona also was awarded a 2016 Guggenheim Fellowship. Ramona talked about representation in filmmaking, drawing universal experiences out of minutiae, and the story she's interested in telling. Here's our conversation. You grew up in the Philippines.
Yes, I did.
What part of the Philippines did you grow up in?
I grew up in the capital, Manila. And I was born and raised there. I came of age there, actually. And I'm what you call a martial law baby, because that was when the Marcoses were still in power. So I grew up under martial law.
I know that whatever your default is as a child is the only reality you know, of course. But what was it like to be a martial law baby, in your words?
I was so young when martial law was declared, so I didn't really know what that meant. I just knew that school was canceled, so I was very happy. But then there was a lot of military on the ground. There was curfew. So imagine growing up with curfew. We had to be home by midnight, and I think curfew was from midnight to 6 a.m., I believe. And there was a travel ban. You couldn't travel. So that's what I remember. And so as a teenager growing up with curfew, that was very interesting. So you had to, our parents actually would rather we stay all night at one place, come home at 6 a.m., than try to beat curfew, because that was, that's more troubling, right? So that's what I remember of my childhood. I led a very cloistered life.
Did it seem normal to you at the time, or did you have a sense that things should be different?
Everything becomes normal after a while, which is also a little scary, right? It's troubling that things are normalized, but you get used to it. But of course, you knew, after a while, martial law was nominally lifted, the travel ban was lifted, and so was curfew. So it wasn't forever. So you knew it wasn't normal, in quotes, but then you learned to live with it. Also, I was so powerless. I was a child, right? I couldn't really, I couldn't drive. My life was not in my hands at that time.
What did your parents do?
My parents, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. I had six siblings, so we were seven. And my father had a lot, he took care of the family business. We had a lot of, he had property.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
A photographer. That's where I started. I remember my father actually is very, he was the enabler. he gave me my first camera. It was a Canon EO1, right? AE1. I forget now. I remember that. And I would just go around taking photographs, even then. So that's what I wanted to be.
What was it about photography that you loved?
I loved being the observer. I was never a I would never participate, willingly. That wasn't my go-to. But I would love observing things around me. That was my, that's my comfort zone, even until now.
I think that quality really comes through in your films, actually, because some documentaries I see seem to be much more participatory on behalf of the filmmaker, and yours are very stand back, take it all in, kind of, especially with Motherland. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I love it because I think if you let life happen in front of the lens, it'll give you much more than anything you've ever planned or dreamed of. Yeah. So I've always wanted to just look at life, observe.
What brought you to the States?
I came here for college. I actually went to Emerson College in Boston. So I was young. I was 18. and that's what brought me here.
How did you find the transition to be?
You know, I was, you know, when you live in the Philippines, you're very familiar with the U.S. You know, we were a commonwealth. The Philippines was a commonwealth of the United States. One of the only colonies of the U.S. for 40 years. So it seemed everything seemed familiar to me. And also, I grew up with the language, you know. English is the language of business, of education. So it was comfortable for me. Of course, the weather was like, oh my God, the first winter, I thought I was going to die. So my whole college was about like scheduling my classes around weather, around the seasons. Because I really, that was the one thing. That was the one thing that really failed me, the weather.
Were you able to go back home
often? Oh, yeah. Holidays and summer breaks in the beginning. And then, of course, as, you know, as the years, when you get into your, you know, junior year, your last year, I stayed in the U.S. more and more. I got an internship in Los Angeles, so I stayed there for the summer, which was a lot of fun.
At that time, you were studying photography?
Then I was studying film.
So with a minor in photography. How did you decide to go into film?
Oh my God, because I was just fast. You know, I used to, in the Philippines, the films that were available to me were either blockbuster franchise Hollywood films or whatever was showing at the cultural centers like Guti House and the Alliance Francaise in Manila, or independent Filipino films. In those days, it was really thriving. Lino Broca, Bernal. And then I would watch like Truffaut, like Day for Night or Fassbinder at the Getty House. So, and I remember my father would drive me to those places because they were not easy to get to. And there were like one screening on a Tuesday night. But that's why I always say he was my enabler. He would take me to them and make sure I'd get to them for some reason. I never realized it till like many years later that he really was encouraging of it, even if he didn't articulate it as such. That's how my interest in film started.
At the time when you would grow up and go to these films, was it clicking with you that they were making the impact they were?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always say like François Truffaut's Day for Night. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but it is a movie within a movie. So it shows you the process of making a movie. I thought it was the most romantic thing. I'm like, I want to do that. That's what I want to do. It seems so fraught with like tension, and it was romantic, but it was also fun. And you formed community and family around these very transient relationships, which I found really interesting. And I thought, I want to be part of that. That sounds really cool. And it also, I think, appealed to my observer self, right? Where you get involved only for a little bit of time and then you move on. So yeah, that was like a very, I still remember that film so much.
Why documentaries and not fictional narratives?
I started in fiction, actually. So I studied fiction at Emerson. And then right after graduating, I went to Los Angeles and I worked on a television series for, I think, 3-4 years until it ended. And by the time that ended, the series ended, I think I felt like I needed a change. It was a great gig right after college. I mean, you're working on a major television series. All my meals were paid for. I thought every job was like that, you know? But after a while, I felt like I needed to do something else. And by then, the Marcoses had left. They had been ousted from the country. So I went back to the Philippines, actually. And it was amazing because there were so many stories being told. I mean, there was freedom of expression, freedom of the press was non-existent during martial law. So when they left, when the Marcoses were ousted, when the regime ended, there was so many stories to tell, right? And I think that's where my love for the documentary form took root, because they're just... And it also then circled back to my love of photography, documentary photography especially. And then, but then I realized I had all these stories, but I didn't know what to do with them. And I didn't have the skills. I wasn't also very familiar with the documentary form. I just knew there was something there. So I went back to grad school in the States.
And then you did Imelda?
Then I did Imelda as my first independent film after grad school.
How were you able to get that kind of access as your first film after grad school?
You know, if I had known then what I know now, I don't think I would ever have done it. And that's actually funny because that's something Imelda would say, right? She would say, oh, I was so naive then. Naivete saved me. And in a way, yeah, me too, because I was doing a thesis film for my grad studies. This was actually a program for documentary filmmaking at Stanford, just documentary filmmaking. And my thesis film was about the people power movement that ousted the Marcuses, but seen through a very female point of view. I was looking at the women who stood up against the regime, and really particularly middle-class women, because they had everything to lose, but they stood up against him. And in that film, I said, you know, I really have to interview Mrs. Marcos, because she has to be a voice in this film. She was like the premier female voice for so long during the martial law years. So I had it in my head, I'm going to interview her. I'm going to, you know, get to her. So friends, you know, through like networks and friends and people, I was able to actually get a letter to her through her son. I remember I crashed a cocktail party because someone told me that her son was going to be there. I said, I'm going. So I went. I went up to him. I said, I really need to interview your mother. I'm making my thesis film, blah, 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 blah. And he was like, sure, I'll give it to her. I'm like, great. So really, at the end of the, we were in the country for, I think, 3 weeks. And toward the end, we were given the interview. I mean, a call came in and said, yeah, sure, you have 15 minutes with Mrs. Marcus because she just came from hospital, so she's not feeling well. And you can ask her anything but the revolution. I'm like, well, that's what my film's about.
Yeah. Sounds like a lot of journalist interview requests, too. You can ask about anything except what the actual story is about,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Right. But, you know, I figured, wow, but I have 15 minutes with Imelda Marcos. I'm not going to turn it down, right? Who cares if she, you know, let's see. So we went. And I think that 15-minute interview turned out to be like 3-4 hours. She just kept talking and talking and talking. And then she brought up the revolution. And then I felt like, okay, it's fair, right? Once she brings it up, I didn't. And I felt like, okay, then I can ask her. And she's actually in my thesis film only once. And she tells this whole story about leaving the palace. And it's an amazing story. She's a great storyteller, actually. And when I released my thesis film, it did some festivals. Everyone just wanted to know about Imelda Marcos. So I remember one Q&A, someone asked me, what's your next film? I said, Imelda Marcos. I had no idea whether she would really agree to do a whole film, but I felt like, huh, I can do this. So I just said it, and then suddenly it became real. You know, once you say it, then it becomes real. I'm like, okay, I'm going to get access. And I circled back, asked her, and she's like, of course, yes. You should make an entire film about me. That's very typical of Mrs. Marcos. So that's how it happened.
How do you think you're able to build trust with your subjects? And I'm also curious if you think your identity as a Filipino comes into that, because so many of your films have been about Filipino people.
Oh, for sure. For sure it does. I speak the language, for one. And I'm very patient, you know, because I really trust, once I choose the subject of the film and the participants, I really trust that something's going to happen. So I just, you know, I just really, and I tell them, I really make it a point to draw a line between me, what I like to, what it is I do, and the media, news, right? Because I don't really do news. So I tell them that it's not about, and also reality television, it's not about that. So it's not about the gotcha moment. It's not as if what I'm filming this morning will be in the news tonight. It's going to take a few years. And they're like, that boggles them. What do you mean a few years? No, yeah, I'm going to be filming with you over a period of time. So I think patience and time, really. And really getting them to understand what it is I'm doing. And actually getting them on your side. Because people say yes a lot of times, but they don't really know what they're saying yes to. Because it's a lot of work on their part, too. Even if I'm not asking them to do anything special for the film, I'm still around them, right? But I think there comes a time in the process that they turn a corner and they're as invested in the film as you are, as I am. And so that time always comes. You know, it takes time, though. But you have to realize it when it happens. Then you don't have to push as much. Then they will keep you informed of their life. And, you know, if something comes up that's really interesting and important, they let you know. Yeah.
I'm curious about what kind of responsibility, if any, you have to your subjects. And is it ever difficult when you have this vision for your film, you spend years with these people, you obviously become closer to them. Does that vision ever mismatch with, you know, the reality or with the relationships that get in the way?
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's always a question. It's always an ethical question that I ask myself constantly. Because although, yeah, I do spend a lot of time with them, and it always, you know, there are three films always, right? The film that you imagine before ever shooting, the film you think it's going to be while you're shooting, and the film that you end up with when you get your editor involved. And that's like usually three different films. And usually what you end up with is always the right film. It's always like, oh, it's been this film all along. And I spend years, not year, well, okay, a year, couple years with the participants in my film. And I know that there is a relationship. I get close to them, but there's always a line. I know I'm holding the camera, right? So it isn't like a ordinary friendship or relationship. And I know I always have to draw the line. And I try to make them understand that. I made a film about teachers here in Baltimore, The Learning. And they were new immigrants to this country, to Baltimore. And, you know, I felt like, and they needed a lot of very simple things, like how do they get to the grocery store? How do they get a phone? You know, very simple things that you take for granted living here. And so, then I have to, you know, ask myself, how much will I help them, right? Because then I can't be that friend that will always help them, because there is a line. And I make that very clear to them as well, because I don't want to fool them into thinking it's, you know, of course, but there's always a relationship formed, obviously. Mm-hmm. I'm still in touch with a lot of the people I've filmed over the years.
Do you consider yourself a Baltimore filmmaker?
Yes. Now I do. You know, it's been a while. And I've made all my films while living in Baltimore, because when I made Imelda, we actually moved here when I was finishing that film. And I've made all my films here ever since. So, yeah, I do feel that. Yeah.
Are there any unique challenges or advantages to making films out of Baltimore?
Both. They're both. I mean, for me, the advantage is I can do work. You know, I like the quiet. You know, I like to think. That's why I like coming back home to Baltimore, because then I can either just stay home and really think about my films and really write. I like a lot of, I love quiet, you know, and that's what Baltimore represents for me. Because when I go to LA, New York, it's simply because maybe I don't live there. It's constantly like, there's constantly something going on. And I'm not sure I can live in that situation, you know, live in the situation where you feel like you always have to be out somewhere. You know, obviously in Baltimore, some people feel that, right? But that's not what Baltimore is for me. Baltimore for me is, if I want to be out all that every night, that's possible too, right? Because there's stuff going on every night, obviously. But I choose not to. I can really feel like, no, I'm here. I can, you know, I can just do my work. On the other hand, you know, I mean, obviously there's so many things, you know, the center of documentary filmmaking really is New York. So I can't just up and, you know, tonight there's an event, I can't just up and go. Or also gigs, you know, I can't accept a lot of gigs because I live in Baltimore. So there's that.
How have you chosen the subjects of your films?
Well, Imelda, like I told you that, yeah, I've told you. After Imelda did the film festival circuit for such a long time. Like, it was really successful in the film festival circuit. I think I traveled with it for 2 years. That was also my first independent film. So I was like, oh, my God, I can see the world. Make a film and see the world, literally, because it went, you know, to all these international film festivals. And I realized, oh. And then I was coming up, like, I think I was coming up against my, like, two-year anniversary traveling with Imelda. I'm like, oh, I can't do this, because then you can't make other films. Then I realized, you know, I can stop, right? Because I think after making your first film, you feel like you can't say no because you've lived with this film for so long by yourself, maybe your editor, in this sort of vacuum. And suddenly the world sees it and they like it. You feel like, oh, you want to see it? Sure, I'll come, blah, blah, blah. And then I realized, no, I don't have to do that. I can say no. So I stopped and I said, no, I'm not traveling with Imelda anymore. I'm going to find a film that's local to... I also had a young child. She was, I think, in third grade, fourth grade. So I needed to be home more. And, you know, once I decided, no, I'm going to make a film in my backyard, someone read this article in the Baltimore Sun about teachers being recruited from the Philippines, like the Baltimore public school system recruiting teachers from the Philippines. I'm like, huh, there's something there. And so I followed it. I got in touch with the reporter who had written the story. And then she put me in touch with all the teachers she had met. And one thing led to another. Then I was given permission to film in the system, carte blanche, the schools that I had picked. So that's how that happened. Because and that was also because I wanted to stay home. And that was perfect. It was like, shooting in the city. And then what was my next film? Oh, yeah. Don't Stop Believin'.
That was not staying home.
That was not.
That was a lot of tour footage.
Oh, my God. That's just the opposite. But that was, okay, what happened there? We were cutting the learning. We were in post-production on the learning. And someone sent me an email that was going viral within the Filipino and Filipino-American community. The consul who had given Arnel Pineda, the main character in the film, the American consul in the Philippines, at the American Embassy in the Philippines, had written this really funny email about Arnel getting his visa because he actually had to sing for his visa.
Really?
It was really a really incredible. Imagine, like, an American consul at the American Embassy in the Philippines. They've heard every story, right? It's very difficult to get an American visa.
And you have to prove you basically have an exceptional talent that an American couldn't have that job, right?
Right.
So he basically had to prove, okay, like only Steve Perry could do
this, because,
or me.
I mean, he goes up to this window and then, like you said, reason for traveling. Oh, to audition for the band Journey. And so the consul is like, the band Journey.
Right.
And he goes, yeah, the band Journey. So he showed all this like printout of emails that went, back and forth between him and the management of Journey and Neil Sean, who's the co-founder of Journey. He goes, I've heard so many stories in my life, but this is so unique. So I want you to sing. And if you have a great voice, I'll give you your visa. If you make me believe that you're really auditioning, and I'm going to put you on the speaker. So he put Arnel on the speakers, and everyone, I think he sang Wheel in the Sky, and everyone at the American Embassy in the Philippines heard him sing, and they were like, oh my God. So he got his visa. I have to say that the consul got into trouble, though, because he shouldn't have done that.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Like against the law or something, and that he wrote about it in an email that went viral. I mean, it's crazy.
Oh, so for security reasons or something?
Yeah, and so he got censured for that. So I have to say that. So I read this email. I'm like, wow, this is so incredible. What a story. And then he got the gig. And usually I wouldn't read those emails, right? They come in and I put them in the trash or whatever. But I read it. And then I clicked on the link at the bottom of the email. And I seldom do that. I clicked on the link and there was Arnel Pineda singing at the Hard Rock Cafe in Manila. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is his voice was incredible. So I sent the email to my manager in Los Angeles and I said, look, Peter, this is a great, you should read this email. Ha ha, it's so funny. Someone should make this film. And he got back to me. He goes, you should be making this film. Stand by. I'm like, no, really, because the music rights will be hellish. I really don't want to handle music rights. He goes, oh my God. He goes, don't turn it down because of music rights. That's stupid. So one thing led to another, and pretty soon I was talking to their management and we were negotiating. It went back and forth for a long time until they finally gave us permission to follow them.
And then you were on tour with Journey.
Then I was on tour with Journey with no money. But my producer, who's local actually, Capella Fahum, I showed her a trailer and she's like, so what are you doing? I'm like, I don't know. We don't have money. I mean, I don't raise money that quickly. She goes, are you crazy? Girl, we gotta go. So she's like, she crewed up, she hired, you know, she, I don't know, she rented this like van and we were on tour.
And then that brings us to Motherland, your newest film. So tell me about the inception of that.
Motherland was a very different film when it first began. I was thinking about reproductive health and reproductive justice at the time. And this also came at the tail end of Don't Stop. And Don't Stop was a crazy film to produce because it involves so many people. And it was like a crazy film to produce. So my thinking at the end of that process was like, I want to make a quiet film. I want to go back to just me and my DP and my sound person, just a crew of three and just quieter and back to the observational footage that I wanted to do. And for some reason, I was thinking of reproductive justice and reproductive health at that time. I don't know why, but I was obsessing over that. And there was a law that was passing, going through the halls of Philippine Congress that was sort of eliciting a lot of social drama around it because it was a reproductive health law. That it's a very Catholic country, the Philippines, so birth control, contraception, all that's very, controversial for them. But I felt like the country was turning a corner and sort of cutting its apron strings with the church. So I felt it was a good story to hang the themes. And then, of course, when I got there, it was tough. I knew then I couldn't really make the film I wanted to make because that required me living in the Philippines. And I couldn't do it then, or spending months and months there. I couldn't do it. But researching that, while I was researching the film, someone said, you really have to visit Fabella Hospital in Manila because that's where, it's a baby factory. So when I went there, then I knew, okay, this is where my story is. The film will just take place within the walls of this hospital. There was so much happening. It was incredible. I couldn't get those images out of my head.
And so you really see that tension of, you see the reproductive justice issues and the Catholicism coming to a head just in these women's stories. Like for people who haven't seen it, the people who work at the hospital will try to educate the women about family planning or contraception, and a lot of them say, my mother doesn't want me to, or it's wrong, but they don't have reasons beyond that. And just by quietly kind of filming these women, those stories all come to a head. Absolutely.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, it was still dealing with all the themes I wanted to deal with, but organically out of this one space. It happens all within the buildings of the hospital. And I'd always, I love the observational way of filming. I love observational docs. It's why I do documentaries. I love surprises and sort of the narrative emerging from the scenes, and life really unfolding in front of the lens. I love that. It's sometimes a very scary way to shoot because you don't know where it's going. But that's, to me, exciting. And that's why I love doing documentaries. And Motherland is my first, purely observational documentary. It was kind of really liberating filming that because I didn't want to do interviews because I really felt like, no, I don't have to do interviews. These people are just giving me access to their most intimate conversations at the hospital. And I felt like, what would they tell me in an interview that I wouldn't get from all the scenes? And I was really convinced of that. So we didn't really film any interview. We just really filmed life unfolding.
And especially because such of the close quarters, I feel like it forced those kinds of conversations too. It's like multiple women sharing a bed and all these babies lying around. So those happened quite a lot.
The public space or private space, right? The private space is redefined in the hospital, right? Because you really have to share a lot of those spaces with other people. And also, I love the very fleeting relationships, very profound relationships that form within the women, but they're very fleeting. They'll never get in touch with each other again after the hospital, right? Because the lives outside the hospital are very beleaguered. And I love, to witness that those relationships form, and it's never going to happen again, right? They're not lifelong friends. And they meet at the time when they've just given birth. There's something about it that's so, heartwarming. And I don't know. To me, it's breathtaking to watch those relationships form.
And relatable, I think. Even if you are not in a super crowded Filipino hospital giving birth, I think everyone's had those kinds of relationships that just come into their life for a brief period of time and are intense and then kind of fleeting.
Thank you for saying that. No, really, because that's always what I hope to do in my films, you know. I really try to coax out whatever is universal, you know, whatever is relatable. Because I think there's always something that speaks to people, even if it's a very specific situation. So I always make this, I always try to make my films transcend its specificity, you know. So thank you. I love that you said that.
Beyond telling the stories of the very diverse stories of all of these Filipino subjects and beyond your kind of observer nature, I'm curious if you think that there is a common thread between all of your work or what it is that draws you to a story and makes you feel like you have to be the one to tell it.
That's an interesting thing. I would say I'm really drawn to women's stories, and most of my work really is about women, right? Except, of course, Don't Stop. That was the opposite.
That was a dude fest.
Yeah. But that was a story that, like, it's like catching lightning in a bottle, right? That film, because it was happening and, you know, reluctantly I did it. I'm glad I did it. I had such a great time doing it. Great and also very difficult. But mostly I'm drawn to women's stories, to female stories, I think. You know, I'm the only one working in this space. I tell Filipino stories mostly, and I get it distributed here in the U.S. I mean, it's like Motherland will be seen nationally on POV, on public television. It's going to have a theatrical release. So I work in that space, and I feel like I'm the only one really doing it. So there's a kind of responsibility, I feel, to tell those stories because I'm the only one really telling. I'm not the only one telling those stories, but I'm the only one who's been able to get that kind of distribution.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about representation because, you know, I don't closely follow the world of documentary filmmaking, but I think if you just read any kind of passing thing about Hollywood in this day and age, you will know that there are not many female filmmakers, not many Asian American filmmakers. So is representation important to you? And did you have anything to kind of look up to in that regard?
Oh, yeah. I mean, representation is a big part of my process, you know. It's always been for me, this, in a way, the burden of representation, since I'm one of the few voices out there who are talking about, who are making the films, the kind of films I make, right? But growing up in the Philippines, you know, I had a lot of female role models. So when I came to this country for university and the issue of me being a woman and therefore not being able to do everything that I thought I could do was new to me. I came here thinking, of course I can. I mean, in the Philippines, there was never a question of not being able to do it. Now it may have been a function of class, obviously. And also, I think my parents. And also, just the people around me. You know, I just felt like women were doing all kinds of things in the Philippines. I also grew up, you know, with Imelda Marcos as a role model. Whether, I mean, good or bad, right? She was out there. She was really front and center. And of course, she, you know, in the end, didn't turn out so well. But still, she was a very powerful woman.
Yeah, she had a lot of international influence. Yeah, like you said, whether it was good or bad, but she had people's ear.
Exactly. So when I came to this country, I'm like, wow, really? That's an issue? That's a thing that you... But I guess not having ever grown up with it, I just felt like, no, me, it's not going to happen to me. So in a way, that naivete again. So I forged ahead, like, no, I'm going to do this. What's the problem? Of course, then more and more, the microaggressions, right, pile up. And then you realize it. I'm like, oh, yeah, it is true. But now, at least they're talking about it. Right? I mean, there's so much talk in the entertainment industry about representation and female directors and Asian American representation, especially in big Hollywood films. At least now it's being talked about. What we talked about in dark corners of like all these conferences amongst the Asian American filmmakers are now out in the open. We can actually talk about it and feel comfortable. So I think, we have a long way to go, but I think it's a start. This is actually a conversation we can have openly.
Do you think you were naive to those kinds of things in the Philippines because you weren't yet working, because you were young, or because you weren't in the minority, or why do you think you were kind of shielded from that in that way until you got to the States?
Because, in the Philippines, like I said, I think because of the people around me. I mean, I had a lot. There was no different. Of course, there is. You know what I mean? When you really look at it, but there were a lot of women around me who were strong and powerful and successful growing up. And you're right, I never worked there, right? So that may have been different. But then all the women around me that I looked at were like doing their thing. And it was never a question, like, especially my parents. It was never a question of what I could and couldn't do. You know, yeah, absolutely. You can do, yeah, whatever you want to do, you can do it. So I think it's also, but like I said, I think it's a matter of class as well. I mean, with poverty, it comes a lot of like indignities, right? And you feel powerless. So because we were middle class, I think the opportunities and my role models were female and also, I don't know, strong.
I know you have said that because you grew up in the Philippines and then came to the U.S., in some ways in your filmmaking, you feel like an insider and an outsider. And I was hoping you could kind of tell me more about that perspective.
I have one foot in and one foot out, right? Because when I go to the Philippines to film, I can speak the language, because I blend in, right? I pass, right, in the Philippines. It's an insider voice. But then, you know, having lived here for a long time, I can't step back and look at things from the outside looking in. When I go back to the Philippines, since, you know, I still sometimes call it home. I'm going back home, which really bugs my daughter. But that's another story. when I go back to the Philippines, it's immediately I know where things are. I know what to do, you know. So there's that very inside feeling. But then once I start making my films, I can step back and look at things from a sort of, for lack of a better term, a Western point of view.
And see maybe a blind spot that people in anyone's own culture are not always able to see.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, so many. But, you know, there's still things that I take for granted. That's why I like taking a crew from here, a DP from here, because they see things that are so, like, new to them. And I'm like, really? That's, you know, is that interesting? Because there are, of course, some things that go over my head. I'm like, yeah. Those jeepneys, they've been here forever. That thing happens forever. You know, that thing. So that's why it's a new eye. But also there are things that happen that I know, that's particularly the Philippines. I still have that voice inside my head, that Filipino voice inside my head. But I know it as such. I can step back and realize, that is that Filipino voice.
What are the stories you think are not being told right now and what's interesting you for your next project? Granted, I know that Motherland hasn't even had its big release yet, and you'll be doing everything that comes along with that. But yeah, what is interesting to you right now?
I'm actually starting my next film already, which I can't talk about so much. But obviously, the political situation in the Philippines is very interesting. I'm not sure if you know what's happening, but we have a kind of very interesting president at the moment who is, a lot of people compare him to Trump, but I think he's very different from Trump, but he is a populist. He has a very interesting way of speaking where there are no filters on him as well, maybe just like Trump, but he was a politician in the past, so he knows how to work the system. He's also, I think, more grounded in policy than Trump, maybe. So that's interesting, the political situation. But I'm not the kind of filmmaker that goes after breaking news, right? Because that's just not what I do. And I like immersing myself in someone's life. So I think there's something in there. I'm not quite sure yet.
what, but there's something that I'm going to make. I don't know yet, but yeah, I just feel it. There's a story there.
Ramona, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Thanks for listening to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. You can find Female Trouble anywhere you get your podcasts, like iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also follow us on Twitter at FML Trouble and find more online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring Baltimore's own TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back next week.